Okay, we've been talking about the spread of Hellenism, the impact of the spread of Hellenism, and answering really a question that was even brought up, which you guys were wonderful prompts yesterday for every movement of my lecture. There was a question I was like, oh, well, that's next in my notes. But the question was, how is it that Alexander the Great can unify an empire this big, especially whenever he's out conquering? Now, there will be a secondary answer to this. One of the things that we did say was Hellenization, and we'll talk about that more in just a minute. But one of the things is honestly, after Alexander the Great starts his way back and dies, all of this pretty much goes back to whoever it belonged to. It's not like the Greek Empire holds on to this very long. Now, he does go through and he does conquer all of this, but they don't hold it. Matter of fact, it's pretty much Babylon, Mesopotamia, and within about 100 years, it actually gets pushed all the way over to kind of the Syria-Judea border. So, I mean, it's not like the Greek Empire holds this super long time, okay? But the area that they do hold primarily, which is going to be right here, although they don't do a great job of that. We'll see that in just a minute. Is Hellenization. Hellenization is what holds it together. It's kind of the glue that holds it together, the bonding agent. In Hellenization, we have education, or like language, myths, we have entertainment, we have religion, some key components that they utilized in order to actually accomplish this diverse unity, okay? Somewhat of a unity, although it's not unity on the level that the Romans will accomplish. Because one of the things the Romans add into it that it develops deeper unity is transportation. The transportation that the Romans are able to accomplish is something that the Greeks never really did well. So the carving of roads through mountains, or, you know, the Via Ignatia, the Via Appian. I mean, these are massive accomplishments that allow for expediency of soldiers, of armies, to help make sure they can police better. But then number two, also expediency, and especially overseas, with some of the nautical lanes, the pirates being taken up, they'll have an expediency of transportation that helps them be more unified in a way the Greeks never were able to be. But their culture was amazing, okay? And it really helped lock things into place. And what we have is that, now remember, we're talking about all of this in order to answer questions about that region for the Gospels, okay? So I want to keep that always in front of our minds. We're not just talking about history for the sake of history. We're talking about history for the sake of how it actually is going to impact this region and how that then impacts our understanding of the Gospels. Okay? What we have is in response to Hellenization. Hellenization, remember, is a 90% of scholarship, learning terms. Hellenization is what? Yeah, and that culture specifically is the Greek culture, Hellenization. So if they are Hellenistic Jews, it means they are Grecian or Greek, because etymologically, that's the Greek symbol or the Greek. What's the word? What am I looking for? Something. It's Greek. Hellenization. You have two responses to Hellenization. You have a lot of Jews buy into it. They love it. Matter of fact, we'll talk about this in about 150 years or so, that we will see priests that are loving Hellenization of Jerusalem so much that they're actually neglecting their sacrificial duties in the temple to go participate in the gymnasium games. Like, that's about 150 years away, but a lot of Jews like this Hellenization, and they buy into it. But if you have one group that's moving this way, what's the other end of the spectrum of how other people are going to respond? They're going to hate it with a viciousness. They're going to calcify their identity, become even more staunchly conservative. I mean, you see this even in our culture today. The more that this side moves to the left, the more that this side pushes to the right, and both extremes move to an absurdity. And that's kind of what you see here with Hellenization. You see both of them starting to move. So a particularism is starting to be infused inside of Jewishness that we'll see carry over into the New Testament. Okay? Next major date, 323. 323, Alexander dies of a fever in Babylon. He dies of a fever in Babylon. give you an idea of where Babylon's at. There's your Mediterranean on your left. Babylon's right there. He dies in Babylon of a fever at the age of 33. He does all this before he's 33. That's startling. Although that is one thing I can say, well, Alexander the Great was great, but I'm 34, so I beat him. Just kidding. Kind of. It's true, though. It's just a little ominous. Okay. After his death, this-ish is broken up into four pieces. It's not even unified the moment that he dies. You have four different generals, powerful generals, that take over major sections. Your first general is Antigonus. I guess I'll write these on the board. Can you guys see red okay? Or do I need to do a different color? Is that all right? Okay. Antigonus. He is going... let me get rid of Hellenization. Nope. No. Okay. sorry. You got to amuse yourself at times. Antigonus, he takes over Asia Minor. Asia Minor, which whenever I get these all on the board, I'll walk you through it on the map so you can kind of have a visual of what's happening. Okay, Antipater. He takes over Greece and Macedonia. Antipater, Macedonia, and Greece. Ptolemy! So that's interesting for Roman history, but it's not the same guy, I promise. But he takes over Egypt. And then we have Seleucus. It's EU. He takes over Syria, which they would also include kind of Judea in there-ish. So, if we look on the map, we're able to see this a little more clearly. Over in the far west of the empire, you see Macedonia and Greece. That belongs to Antipater. Asia Minor, then, is the one right there. It says Pamphylia and Phrygia. But it's really more like this. This is really eventually Asia Minor. It's really kind of referring to that. That is belonging to Antigonus. Then once we keep moving over, you have Syria. And, I mean, so it's kind of this, although they kind of will be a war over this. And over to here. They kind of keep Babylon in their back pocket as long as they can. But what you have, that belongs to Seleucus, and then down south in Egypt belongs to Ptolemy. Okay? Give you an idea of how they do this. Now, this doesn't last long, so get ready. Yeah?
Was this planned before general thing from Alexander's perspective?
Say it again?
Was this planned from Alexander's perspective to have before general thing?
Depends on what we mean by planned. The part of the Greeks' problem is that they're where they come from. I mean, they come from city-states, which really value autonomy, really value... this group has, because of all their voices speaking, has this opinion, and this group has this opinion. Now, we call ourselves Greek, but we want to have our shared views. So, is this what was Alexander's goal? There's a part of it where I don't even know if it was Alexander's choice. Alexander accomplished something very unique in Greek history, and that is to unify everybody under one voice. It was almost inevitable with where the culture was both before he came to power and after that it would not be able to stay with one person. So maybe part of it was, listen, none of us, all of us want to revere Alexander and none of us can even fall under one, so we're going to split up into four. But whenever you're dealing with kind of a hyper-democracy, splitting it up into four and claiming to be unified was almost inevitable. Does that make sense? So I don't even really know if Alexander had much of a choice, regardless of what he wanted. But this was kind of the plan. It wasn't brought up, it wasn't come about through a bunch of major wars, if that's what you're asking. It was divvied up as peaceful as you can. But I mean, literally within 10 years, they're at each other's throats. So, other questions on that? Yeah.
This might be kind of a long shot, but I'm just curious. Since Alexander the Great was so influential, are there any direct or indirect parallels between him and Jesus in the Gospels?
The problem is our evidence for Alexander the Great is so sparse. Like, we have like a total of like 12 documents and or 12 manuscripts. Like, we just don't have much information. Honestly, the majority of what we have of Alexander the Great comes to us through not many documents at all, especially comparatively speaking. Like, New Testament has 27,000 manuscripts and this one has like 12 or 25. So what we have is about as good as we can get, but it is still vague. I mean, it really is. We just don't have a ton. Yeah.
So is that ever used as like an apologetic argument for like Jesus really did exist? Look at all these documents we have with him. Like, no one doubts that Alexander the Great actually.
Oh yeah, it's.
But there's like no.
Exactly. No, and that's actually one of the key points that Josh McDowell makes in his book Evidence Demands a Verdict. He just says, look at the manuscripts. Let's just at least look at it. But yeah, I mean, it is pretty startling, and that's why. That's why Jimmy Dunn at the beginning of a response in the five views of the historical Jesus, there is a guy that writes in that book that he believes that Jesus never walked the face of the earth. And James Dunn, is that his name? James Dunn, Jimmy Dunn. He responds by saying, I can't even believe people still think this. He's like, I thought this was dead. He's like, after all the evidence that we have, this is the most ludicrous thing to deny his actual physical existence. I mean, in other words, like, you can quarrel about who Jesus claimed to be, but his existence, if Jesus didn't exist with the evidence that we have of Jesus existing, then no one has ever existed. Like, I mean, because it's just absurd. The probability, if we're going to be okay, I mean, there's entire movies made about Alexander the Great. I mean, and it's unquestioned. I mean, whenever you go inside of your textbooks, no one questions anything about any of even the legends of Alexander the Great. It just is what it is. But yeah, I mean, but there's nothing at stake to say that Alexander the Great existed. There's a lot at stake if we say that Jesus exists, especially the way in which he describes himself as existing. So a lot of history will look back on sparse evidence and marvel, unless there is something that it costs them, and then they'll look back on it and figure out ways to negate it or nullify it. Yeah, it is used as an apologetic. But it also is just typical human nature. We do this all the time. And we do this too. Like, I mean, I know it's absurd whenever we see on the historian level how ridiculous this is, but it's like, we do this too. We're just usually a lot more sneaky, you know. You know what I mean? We all try to wiggle away from the impact of the pervasiveness of Christ's existence. We do this. Judas did this. Peter did this. Paul did this. I do this. It's not the goal, it's just kind of the way that humans function. Without the Spirit, and at this point, I should say. Because there's a plan to rectify that. But that's a different class. And yet it's in every class. Okay, I'm sorry.
Why do you think it is that there's so few manuscripts?
It's just, honestly, it's, I mean, most of, well, this is one of the things I always, let me say it the opposite way. I am always thankful that we have anything of any part of history, because everything that we have from history is an accident. It is an improbable accident. And what I mean by that is it's just going like, number one, it's ridiculous that the stuff that we do have, like manuscripts, even survives hundreds and even thousands of years. I mean, shoot, a lot of us struggle with just not having our paper that's bound and stuff not get all ratty and torn up and but manuscripts made out of stuff that's a lot more feeble to last, sometimes laying on top of or underneath the earth and not having water. I mean, it's just crazy. We have anything. So whatever we have, I'm super thankful for, although I do get frustrated at times. You know, it's like, I mean, Tacitus doesn't have a single one of his works that's totally complete. And the one work I was most interested in, it stops the date right before I wanted it to, which is just frustrating. You know, Suetonius, it's probably the most extant of a document that we have from the first century, or first, second century, he's right in the second century, but we still miss like a chapter and a half out of that book, maybe even some more, but it, you know, but probably about a chapter and a half. What we do have is a blessing. It's a gift. It's an accident. I mean, all that's true. So, for example, I don't know if you guys saw the news, but they just found a whole new cache of manuscripts inside of a new cave down in Qumran. So the Dead Sea Scrolls is about to expand. And right now, there's a lot of... it's not exactly clear how many they've actually discovered, but it's possible we could have an influx of a multitude of more manuscripts. And it's an accident. I mean, whenever you see where they're at and where they find it, they're like, yeah, they found it in the cave. Well, don't picture cave. I mean, the guy's like laying down like this, and he's like digging up into the thing. I mean, there's no space. So they've crawled like back into these tunnels, and they found something new. And it's like, what were the odds of that? I mean, even the way Dead Sea Scrolls were found, it was Bedouin's cousins that were just through a rock looking for a lamb, and they heard a cracking noise. It's like, what if they never would have thrown a rock into the cave? You know what I mean? Like, whatever we have is an accident anyway. And it's just a gift. It's just a gracious gift. So whenever you have communities, though, like the early church, that found these documents to be sacred or revered, that's how they also, and I think also Holy Spirit's added in this, but that's how also you get 27,000 manuscripts of something that's, it honestly is unfair, the amount of manuscripts we have, historically speaking, compared to other historical documents. It's just unfair. It's almost so absurd, it doesn't count, but it does. I don't know if that makes sense. It's just like from a historian's perspective, it's like, well, we can't compare everything to the New Testament because then nothing is really worth anything. You know what I mean? So the fact we have, you know, anywhere from 12 to 28 or so documents of Alexander the Great, it's like, well, that's pretty good.
Would that be something that Roman emperors would try and erase the memory of, though?
Could be. Sometimes. So you what you're tapping into, again, is not just the accident of archaeological history, but then also then you have the problem of there's actually purifying movements at times. So, for example, I'm very thankful for every statue we have of Domitian because his memory was damned by the Senate and it was supposed to be eradicated. But we do have stuff. I've seen, like this close, you know, images of Domitian. That's super rare. So, yes, there are times whenever we even have Christian documents that we lost, in the Decius and Diocletian persecutions. It wasn't just, let's go after the Christians, let's also destroy all their documents. Absolutely, that happens at times throughout history. And so we've lost, or just the great fire of Alexandria, where the Library of Alexandria burns down. Now that was accident, but we lost thousands of manuscripts. And that happens. So sometimes it's accidents that just happen on the surface, sometimes it's accidents that actually preserve stuff. Sometimes it's purifying movements. Yeah. I mean, again, whatever we have, it's like, wow, I mean, I'm thankful for that. Let's not overlook it, because that's all we really have. But which in some sense helps with our definition of history and knowing what we're able to piece together. And yeah.
So you mentioned a number of manuscripts, but I've heard, maybe you know a more accurate number, how early the documents are, the earliest, history or gospel of Jesus is within a few decades, out of Alexander, the earliest extant one we have is, 400 years?
Yep. After. Normally around that. That's not too bad, historically speaking, but...
even on that account, people say, it's close enough, there may be some legendary development, but we can construct a pretty good history of them. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And again, it costs the people more. It doesn't matter if we find the original autograph with DNA samples of Paul and his blood written over it. It still would be considered a fabrication. Or it still would be, you may have the autograph, but, there's always ways around it. And that's where, again, it's different whenever you're finding a document that merely is trying to just, in your mind as a historian, just tell you about something. It's way different whenever you encounter a document that's calling you to be something. And so that's one of the reasons why eventually we have to put history in its place. Like, this goes back to some of the earlier conversations we had, and we go, okay, history is a tool. that we get to use in order, by God's grace, to draw closer to his revelation. But it is not the tool. There are things beyond it. But if I use historical criteria, this is the thing that always, this is why I've kind of given up on fighting the game based on the terms of those outside of theology. Because I'm going, every time I play your game, we completely shatter what it is that you're suggesting, and it still doesn't matter. You still find a way around what we're trying to say. So I either, number one, I can just keep playing the game until I eventually think that they will think it matters, or I can just say, you play your game, I've already done that, I'm playing a different game. I'm tired of that. It bores me because I just don't have time for that. Because it doesn't matter. I mean, 27,000 to 28, not 1,000, but 28, and I still have to argue? Within literally not just decades, but maybe even within a decade, I can have a document, and I still have to argue for veracity? It's like, all right, what that tells me is there's nothing I can do. You're never going to, and that is the craziness of our God, is he allows that to be an option for you not to believe. And so I'm going to just say, hey, we have the answers if you want to look at it on your terms, but actually your terms limit what answers we can actually talk about, and I'm going to be focusing on those because that's a playground I just am excited to play on. And so that's where there's a part of this of redefining what history is super helpful, because it both respects their criteria and rejects it simultaneously. And just says, yeah, I mean, you're always going to find a reason why what it is the documents say or something you're not going to bow down to. And I get that. It really has nothing to do with the evidence. It has to do with a wound. So let's talk about that. You know what I mean? Does that make sense? So, I mean, knowing, though, the stuff on their criteria is helpful. Knowing the 27,000, you know, to like 12, I mean, it should prompt us to go, does anybody else think that's weird? Like that Alexander the Great nobody questions, but Jesus, we act like it's, does anybody else find that strange? You know, the Da Vinci Code, people buy that hook, line, and sinker, and there is zilch evidence for this. Zero. None. I mean, it's absurd. And there's like one random comment in like a 600-year-old, I mean, like around the year 600, document that then they use and fabricate this entire thing. And yet, and people are like, well, I mean, there's something to that. Is there? I'm just like, as a historian, I'm just like, this is crazy, like the criteria with which we're looking to dismiss something or embrace something. It's like, ugh. So eventually I'm just like, yeah, nobody cares about what the historian criteria actually is. If they did, then they would take the Bible more seriously. You know, it's kind of like, you know, well, you get the point. Is that making sense? So if apologetics does anything, it can edify. Like, you know, the class itself. Edify, help you be able to address kind of the surface level questions that people have. But honestly, it's like whenever you start to dive into a lot of the historical veracity of the Bible and stuff like that, I'm just like, this is just a crazy conversation because the evidence is so ludicrous. Like, it's so, the scale just is shattered. And I'm just like, why are we even having this conversation? You know? That makes sense? Follow me? And I know every generation needs to come anew to the evidence, and I want to be sensitive to that. I do get bored easy. Okay, we good? Back to old Alex. Okay. He dies. Split up. Okay. In 312, the Ptolemies and the Seleucids team together to become kind of the dominant superpower over everything. So the Ptolemies, Egypt. The Seleucids, Syria, so you can even see on the map why they would team together. I mean, if you're the Ptolemies, you're landlocked. Unless this is somewhat of an ally, you're landlocked. So they team together and they go after Antigonus, which is Asia Minor. Now, technically, Antigonus, even the battle ends up happening in Gaza, so you can see where he was. He had aspirations as well, because Gaza is pretty far south towards Egypt. But they go after Antigonus. They give him an initial defeat in 312, but the official defeat's in 301. In 301, you have Antigonus gone, or deposed, not necessarily killed, but he's no longer a threat. He is gone. What happens during this time, which is super shady, is the Seleucids are actually now promised all of this region. So the Seleucids are promised, okay, as a part of their alliance in defeating Antigonus up here, Seleucids are promised all this region, and the Ptolemies are like, yeah, we'll promise that. The moment the war's over, the Ptolemies move into this region. So the Ptolemies in 301 begin to reign the region that matters most to us for our studies right here. That will last until 198. So they will reign on a region that was promised to someone else for around over 100 years. Okay? So from 301 to 198. Now during this period, the speaker stuff. During this period of reign of the Ptolemies, so 301 to 198, a couple of things happen. Number one, Ptolemy deports a large population of Judea and Jerusalem, and he relocates them in Alexandria. Remember, we eventually will get to a point with the letter of Aristeus, the Old Testament pseudepigrapha, where we have this strong Jewish population in Alexandria. This is how they get there. Ptolemy, whenever he takes over the region, deports a large population of Jews during this time period and sends them to Alexandria, Egypt. And Jews thrived in Alexandria. Absolutely thrived. That'll become important for the church because, you know, Origen, one of our early church fathers around the 3rd century, is in Alexandria. Strong, strong school of study there. That's where the Septuagint will be translated, so for Jewish history. Ptolemy also enters Jerusalem on the Sabbath, pretending to want to offer a sacrifice at the temple, and instead he took the whole city by force. So whenever he comes to power, he does it forcefully by using the Sabbath as a weapon. That's important. I know that sounds like I'm describing an event. I'm actually describing a precedent that will be important over the next 200 to 300 years. So he uses the Sabbath as a precedent against the people. Why? Why is that a weak point for the Jews? Because it's work. This will be a major issue once we get to the Maccabean revolt. Do we fight on the Sabbath or not? But the very first time it's used as a weapon is by Ptolemy. Ptolemy the First uses it as a weapon during this time period. A lot of more Hellenizations happening in the region. We'll get to some more of that in just a bit. What we are now entering into, so around 198, again, I just summarized 105 years, okay? Because we need to move towards something that's going to be more directly impacting. The next period is dominated by the history we find in 1st and 2nd Maccabees. So you guys have read this. Hopefully some of the stuff that you've already read, maybe it wasn't when you were reading it, you were struggling. Well, hopefully now some of the pieces will fall into place. 1st Maccabees, it's covering about a 50-year period from 175 to 125. So Ptolemy, around 198 is whenever they stop reigning. We'll talk about that in just a minute. But then 1st Maccabees picks up just about 15 years after that, 20 years after that. So this next section we're going to be talking about is dominated by 1st and 2nd Maccabees, which are written under what's called the Hasmonean dynasty. You're going to want to know this word. Oh, that's a bad one. The Hasmonean dynasty. We'll eventually get to what that word means in totality, but it is kind of the Jewish restoration dynasty. Although it wasn't totally restored because there were some major things violated, but we'll get there in a bit. Okay. I know some of the stuff I just gave you was fragmented, almost disparate. It's okay. It's going to come together here in just like we have 15 minutes left. 12 minutes. Perfect. Okay. We ready? 198. That's your next major date. 198. Antiochus III. This is not Antiochus Epiphanes. We'll talk about him in a bit. Antiochus III defeats Ptolemy V, giving the Seleucids control over all of Judea. So 198, the Seleucids take back the land that was supposed to be theirs over 100 years earlier. They take back that land with the defeat, Antiochus III over Ptolemy V. So the Seleucids are feeling pretty good about themselves. I mean, you don't have Antigonus or any of the people that were after him up in Asia Minor, so you kind of reign over that region. You still haven't really messed with Macedonia and Greece, but they kind of have their own problems because of what's going to happen in 10 years. But now the Ptolemies have been kind of relegated down here to Egypt. And you, as Seleucids, you got this and over into Babylon. So you're feeling pretty good about where you're at. And then 10 years later, something happens. In 188, Rome defeats the Seleucids in battle. Rome is rising. The Punic Wars of the 3rd century BCE are over, and they are looking to expand. They are not the world superpower yet, but it's coming. Rome defeats the Seleucids in battle, and this is a big, big move. You want to remember this, because this is going to be a domino effect that will impact even down to Antiochus Epiphanes, okay? Rome puts on them a major tax. The fancy word for that is indemnity. A major indemnity. Major tax. They call it the Peace of Apamea, the Pax of Apamea. But anybody that's taken my Roman history class knows that peace like beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Apamea. Peace of Apamea. The Peace of Apamea says this. Number one, the Seleucids have to agree to evacuate all territories west of the Taurus Mountains. And what does that mean? It's that region right there. Everything west, they have to evacuate. That's a major problem. Because this region, this is Asia Minor, I mentioned this last class, very rich in resources. Very rich. So if you're the Seleucids, you're evacuating what's west is a big problem. Why? Because what's really rich is Asia Minor. They have a ton of resources, different resources, but what's also rich is Egypt. You have some richness over here, but you can't press too far over here because there's other people that are warring against you. Judea is not all that rich in resources. So, they didn't necessarily wipe out the Seleucids, but it limited them by limiting their resources. So, the Peace of Apamea, move one, says, you have to evacuate all territories west of the Taurus Mountains, which hurts. Number two, you have to surrender all of your war elephants. I know that sounds silly, but Rome struggled with Hannibal in the 3rd century BCE because Hannibal introduced war elephants, and it was wiping them out. Because they were so massive, they had no way of countering the way in which they were being used. And so Rome finally dealt with Hannibal, were able to get over that difficulty. They were using war elephants at this point, but they wouldn't allow the Seleucids. Why? Because if you have war elephants and they don't, then you have the upper hand. Okay? So Peace of Apamea, get away from the west. No more war elephants. They had to surrender the majority of their navy. Which again, that goes back to the Punic Wars, Carthaginians. That's actually the first Punic War. Rome struggled with, you can see Carthage on the very far side of Rome. Rome struggled in the first Punic War with Carthage because Carthage was really advanced in their naval battle. Now Rome ends up catching up with them and beats them at their own game in the first Punic War. But then what happens, well, this is more Roman history, but then what happens in the second Punic War is that instead of going a naval battle at them, what happens is Hannibal decides to go up here, the Apennine Mountains, and come down there with war elephants, and he starts wiping out Rome. The guy was nuts, but incredibly successful. So Rome is putting stuff in the Peace of Apamea that to us seems weird, But to their recent history makes total sense. No war elephants. No more navy. We're going to be getting rid of the Seleucid navy. They agree also to recruit no soldiers from Greece or the Aegean Islands. So Greece and the Aegean Islands, you can't get any soldiers from Antipater. He's kind of being cut off from any of his allies. And he's being squeezed. Why? Rome, while they are definitely have their eye over here on Asia Minor, that's a big win, they're trying to squeeze out here in the middle too. And there's some stuff that's already happened with Corinth and things of that nature. They've already made their way into that region, but there are still some power to be gained there. So, Peace of Apamea, west of the Taurus Mountains, war elephants, navy, you cannot recruit soldiers from Greece and Aegean lands. And then, this is the big one, this is the big domino. They have to pay an indemnity, a tax, of 15,000 talents. Over 12 years, 15,000 talents. That is an exorbitant amount of money. 12 years. I mean, you're talking equivalent today, you'd be in the billions. I mean, the tax is very, very intense. So if, and here's the major problem. If you are the Seleucids, major problem is, in order to pay this tax, you need resources. And what have they done? They've hemmed you in. They've taken away your resources. So if that's what's happening, if they you have this tax, Rome is squeezing you in, what is it that you're going to need to do in order to pay this? What are the options? There's more than just one option. What are the options? What can you do? Throw some out there. Maybe seek other allies. And the other allies, you're going to have to convince them of going against Rome on some sense, which they could be a little worried about what Rome's doing. The new wisdom has already emerged. What else? What are their options? And maybe one of the things you're going to do is you're going to put most of the load onto the people that are already subjugated to you. And local temples are banking centers. And we do see that. We do see them doing both of those. They try to get other allies, which doesn't really work very well, because actually what's going to happen is the Parthians and people on the over near Babylon are going to start to revolt, which is going to cause you problems too. But we do see them raiding temples. Temples were banking centers. So, I mean, because, I mean, who would attack the temple of a god? If you put your money in there, the god themselves is going to help protect it. But if you're struggling for money, you only have so many options. Find new resources. Get allies, cash out all the resources you have just to pay a tax, but then you're really vulnerable and weak, or increase taxes on your people, or go to just flat out robbery. I mean, these are different options that you can do. None of them are ideal. All of them come with a major risk. But the Seleucids are in a very tough spot. In 187, so you're talking a year after the Treaty of Apamea, or the Peace of Apamea, Antiochus III is killed while raiding a temple of Bel in Susanna. 187, Antiochus III is killed while raiding a temple. And why is he raiding the temple? Because this tax is so intense. What you will see is an intensity, a desperation developing in the leaders of the Seleucids that ends up making some of the decisions that they make that's very oppressive, have a greater goal than just merely oppressing people. Okay? That's going to be an important component as we're going through things like Antiochus Epiphanes. Is this making sense? So these pieces are in play for this region to be terrorized. Okay? We all good on that? So I'm about ready to go to an adjacent storyline. It's important because they'll come together, but we have to talk about something that's happening in Jerusalem. Okay? So that's where we're at right now. In Jerusalem, we have another mini civil war brewing. Maybe that's the way we'll say it. It's more like it's like a feud of families. You have two families inside of Jerusalem that are at odds. You have the Onaiads and the Tobiads. It actually makes it difficult because they rhyme to keep them separated. the Oneids and the Tobiads. The Oneids are conservative, and we'll talk about exactly how conservative. Tobiads are very liberal, and we'll talk about what that means here in a bit. But hopefully some of these major categories up front will help you keep these separated, okay? Key figure of the Oneids is a guy by the name of Simon II. At the time that all of this is happening with the Peace of Apamea and things of that nature, Simon II is high priest in Jerusalem. And we've already talked about how the high priest has become this very prominent position, especially with, you know, the Assyrians, the Persians and the way that they interacted with them. And so Simon II, an Oneid, he is high priest. Now, the reason why that's important is because the reason he's high priest is because his family is of the lineage of Zadok. Zadok eventually becomes, Zadok becomes the lineage at the time of David. He was a priest at David's court, but because of his interactions with Nathan the prophet in 1 Kings, basically all the high priests come from this line after the time of David. The Zadokite line, the Zadokite lineage. His Theoniads have the Zadokite lineage. That's why Simon II is high priest at the time that all this is going down. Okay? Now this component, these are... We have to stop because it's time. We're going to pick back up with this. I'll probably have to redo that tomorrow because there's a lot of pieces moving. Okay, love you guys. See you in the morning.